The MMQB podcast is brought to you by SeatGeek, the best way to find a great deal, pay for your ticket, and get to your seat. Download the SeatGeek app and enter our code MMQB for $20 off your first purchase. We're also sponsored by FanDuel, the leader in one-week fantasy football with more winners and more payouts than any other site. Enter promo code THEMMQB at FanDuel.com to play a risk-free tournament for up to $10. That's the Seahawks defense that we've come to know. They're back. That might be the one of all three of these teams, and Arizona and Carolina are great, but that might be the one I fear the most.
Bill Belichick built his team based on finding guys who were undervalued and creating a system around those players. There was no, this is how I play. Chip Kelly did the exact opposite. Welcome to the MMQB podcast. I'm Robert Mays. He's Andy Benoit. We are not joined by Robert Klumko this week. He is busy with holiday gatherings after his week away covering the teams that may or may not be moving to Los Angeles. But Andy, it is you and me, and we are closer and closer to the National Football League playoffs. It is upon us.
Yeah, and isn't it great? Because I think we talked last week about how we're both kind of into the holiday cheer, and then when the holidays disappear, there's no letdown for football fans because the playoffs begin.
Yeah, that's right. And we have some playoff-relevant games coming in Week 17, not a ton. The NFC, for the most part, is set. The AFC, there's still some wonkiness involved. We will get to all of those scenarios for both conferences later in the show, but we're going to start with a fairly controversial figure, you know, someone who was revolutionary in his time, always was looked at as a bit of an obstinate man, was polarizing, and that is, of course, Axl Rose of Guns N' Roses, who is joining back with his band at Coachella this year. I'm sure that's what you wanted to talk about, Andy.
Oh, yeah, hang me out to dry on a topic I know absolutely nothing about. Who's the rocker Slash? Was he part of Guns N' Roses, or am I thinking of something totally different?
Correct. He is the guitar player for Guns N' Roses. He is a Slash. You know, he slashes, man. He shreds on the guitar, yeah. Wears a top hat, loves cigarettes. Also, fun Slash fact, loves dinosaurs.
Okay. Well, he's the only one I know because I saw him at I went to the Jimmy Kimmel show as a teenager with my parents, which I was very awkward at the beginning of the show because they kind of warm up the audience with vulgarity, quite frankly.
Sure.
But anyway, he was the performer, so that's how I learned about who he was. I'd never heard of him before, which is probably awful, but I got to see him perform.
Big dinosaur fan, great guitar player. The Appetite for Destruction, which is their debut album, came out in 1987. It's a big one for me, and I will probably be at Coachella, so this is great news, but that's not what we're talking about. We are starting with another obstinate, polarizing figure, and that is Chip Kelly, who has been fired as the head coach of the Philadelphia Eagles. That news came down on Tuesday night, and I guess here's where we'll start. It was shocking to me. I did not expect this to happen. I know that it's been a rough year for them. I know that the rumors have kind of been swirling based on how much ownership he took over that roster, the fact that the roster flopped, and there's really no one else to blame but him. Still, after two straight years of 10-plus wins, a couple trips to the playoffs, this is not something I expected to happen either at the beginning of this season or now.
Yeah, me neither. And let's try to figure out why it might be happening. If he's being fired because, like Chris Carter suggested earlier this week, players simply don't like playing for him, and there's a significant rift in the locker room because of his demeanor and his unapproachableness and his, as your word, obstinance, then that's one thing. And that could be an explanation. And really, there's not a lot for us to say because we're not on the inside there. We don't have any knowledge. If it's for the performance, though, and because they're 6-9, maybe headed to 6-10 or 7-9, whatever it is, if it's for performance, then this is exactly how franchises become the Oakland Raiders, because it's way too preemptive. They've won 10 games each of his first two seasons. His approach has not It hasn't flopped. That is, as a coach, his system's worked okay in the NFL, and I really hope it's for inside reasons or locker room reasons, because otherwise this totally changes my perception of Jeffrey Lurie and the Philadelphia Eagles.
We weren't hearing anything about how hard Chip Kelly was to play for a year ago when they were winning 10 games. That's the way this stuff works. When you're losing, all that stuff comes out. When you're winning, it never seems to be public. So I think part of the reason that this has become such an issue is because it's flopped this year. They've played really poorly. They've been where 2 years ago. Do you remember that Monday night game against Washington? Do you remember how they looked?
Yeah.
And just the excitement and the level of just energy that was surrounding that team. It couldn't be further from that right now. They are a miserable team to watch. They are a slog every single week offensively. And that's why we're hearing about this stuff. If his team was still putting up 30 points a game and rolling over people, and they were the most exciting show in football, I don't think anybody would care about Chip Kelly's demeanor.
Well, what I worried about when he got the GM responsibilities is I thought he maybe put himself in this sort of position. Because what do you – and here's exactly what happened was the worst-case scenario for him is that he made some drastic changes, and pretty much every one of them has been a downgrade. Kiko Alonso's had a bad season. He's looked like a guy who doesn't trust his knee. DeMarco Murray's been a disaster. Sam Bradford's been inconsistent at best. They have no speed whatsoever at wide receiver, all players that he's taken, and they have no speed in the secondary, even though they invested big at that position, specifically with Byron Maxwell. Those are huge moves. Every one of them failed. So what do you do with a coach like that? Can you strip a guy of his GM powers and just send him back to being a coach, or does that compromise things? And I don't know how the politics of football works, but he drove outside of his lane, and it's compromised his coaching, or at least his job status as a head coach.
The one comparison that I'm thinking of in terms of the GM getting fired so the coach gets fired too is Mike Shanahan. That's the other one where he had a lot of power. He had decision making in Denver, and that got him. He got fired. He's a good football coach, but he was very poor at picking the players. It's almost as if these are two different jobs, and having to do both of them is completely unreasonable to ask of a human being not named Bill Belichick.
Yeah, and Bill Belichick, my guess is he doesn't do as much of this as people think. He's got a guy, Nick Caserio.
Nick Caserio, exactly.
Yeah, and I don't know this, but it's a hunch that Nick Caserio has a lot of power in the personnel, or Belichick leans on him heavily. I seriously doubt Belichick's doing all of the scouting and final decision-making without any help. But from what I've heard behind the scenes, Chip Kelly tended to fall in that camp a little bit. All the scouting, there were some decisions, rumor has it, decisions that he wanted to make on draft day where he was taking guys – wanting guys who were going in the sixth and seventh round. He was wanting them in rounds 2 and 3 and had to be talked out of things. It's more than just being able to look at players and pick the players. You have to also understand the financial implications with the salary cap, and you have to understand how they translate to the pro game. So it's not just analyzing, oh, he's a good player, he's a bad player. Pro game and college game are wildly different. So you can't look at college players. You have to look at attributes, and that's a whole different animal.
And there are so many differences. Even if we're comparing Chip Kelly and Bill Belichick as coaches who have personnel power, here's the difference between Bill Belichick. I mean, there are many differences, but the biggest difference, Bill Belichick built his team based on finding guys who were undervalued and creating a system around those players and what they did well. There was no, this is how I play, and this is what my guys are going to be like. Chip Kelly did the exact opposite thing. He said, how my guys play, and I'm going to get guys that only do this. They're going to fit into what I do. And he put his stamp – both of those coaches as GMs put their stamp on their franchises. And Chip Kelly did it in the sense that this is my team. There is no way to not link how this team performs with who I am and the job that I did, because this is what I wanted. And that's just not – we've seen so many times in professional sports that that's not how that works. And we see it time and time again with college coaches that come to the NFL. Because in college, you can have a system that carries you. And in the NFL, that's just not how it works. I think Chip Kelly is a fine coach. I think that he did change his actual coaching style and the plays and the system. I don't think were as rigid as people made them out to be. I think there were a lot of similar type of schemes and similar types of ideas to what a lot of NFL teams run. But what he did is he made the rigidity, the rigidity came with the way he chose the players. And that's, in a way, almost worse.
Yeah, and his system is not as revolutionary as people believe. I mean, they don't run anything that hasn't been seen before in Philadelphia. What's different is the presentation, the way they run it, the speed, some of the formations, and some of the pre-snap movement that they use with it. But once the ball snapped, the Eagles are very, very basic, which can be a problem if you're if the other elements, if that speed isn't working for you, if you're not getting early first downs and building drives, as we've seen. But yeah, the system was never anything groundbreaking. It was his, it was all the other stuff, the practice schedules, the way he eventually became the way he picked players, and the way they implemented plays or presented plays to people. And it was unconventional, and it worked for the first 2 years or worked well enough, didn't work a little bit in year three, and that's what leads me to believe there's got to be a personality issue here, because the failure does not outweigh the success here. And it's not easy for an owner to fire a coach. I mean, it costs money to fire a coach. So Jeffrey Lurie is basically paying for Chip Kelly to go away.
I don't know what they would have done a quarterback. You know, Nick Foles has been terrible in St. Louis, so I don't think he's the answer for anyone. But if you have an offense with Jason Peters, Evan Mathis, Jason Kelsey, Lane Johnson, Jeremy Maclin, DeSean Jackson, and LeSean McCoy, I wouldn't want to play against that team.
Right.
But over the course
of... A lot of speed at all those positions. They had it before. Now they're a slow team. They have well below average speed at all their at all positions now on both sides of the ball.
So Chip Kelly took a team that had a lot of talent on it, made it into a team that doesn't have that much talent solely so he could put his mark on it. And that mark got him fired. Whether it's... how he rubbed people the wrong way in picking those players, the fact the players didn't work out. I think all of those factors contribute, and this is where we are. You know, Chip Kelly put all his cards on the table at the beginning of the season, and he didn't have anything. He had absolutely nothing in his hand, and that's the way it's all, that's the way this worked.
I know we can't spend all day talking about Chip Kelly, but one last thing, it was I heard this on my recent road trip, is, well, two parts to it. One is there's not a ton of interest in Chip Kelly as a head coaching candidate in the college or professional ranks right now. His stock is not super high in the inside of the league. That's one. And two, is he a guy you could hire as an offensive coordinator? Because there are people who don't believe he is, based on the personality and the power he's used to wielding. Where does he go from here?
That was going to be my question to you. If you were Tennessee, I don't know, do you call and sit down and see what he has to say?
No. Marcus Mariota's play, he had such a good rookie season playing a way that we know works in the NFL and has been proven. And I think Kelly's system, to a certain degree, diminishes the quarterback enough to where you can't just plug and play anybody. But we saw the success they had with Nick Foles. It's a very specific system. It diminishes the QB, so it doesn't fully maximize the traits if you have a good star quarterback, which I think Mariota can be.
We're a little late in the college coaching carousel now. I think that if he gotten fired 2 weeks ago, he would have had a better shot. But when you say nobody in the college, or a few people in the college ranks are interested in him as a head coach, that's hard for me to believe. I think somebody is going to pull the trigger on him because it's a big name. It gets you, it helps with recruiting. I think it gets your program energized in a way. I would be very surprised if he wanted to go back to college if you were out of a job for more than this season.
Yeah, I would too, and I don't know much about college. I'm just a messenger here. I'm passing along what the word on the street about Kelly is, but I think you're right. He would make sense. Like, I live in Boise. Theoretically, if Boise State wanted to hire Kelly and he would be willing to take that, the town would go bananas for that kind of thing, and that's a higher-end mid-major program. I would think there'd be some big conference programs that would feel the same way.
Yeah, I totally agree. We're in playoff team time, so what we're focusing on here is mostly that area of the league, who's going to be playing, what the matchups might look like. Is there any other news from this week that you wanted to hit before we moved on?
Well, the Peyton Manning was big news, and you and I talked beforehand, and we're both on the same page, which is that we don't care about it. I don't care if he took anything or not, and I could explain why, but I don't care to even bother explaining why. I think it's professional football, and I'm not saying it's right to do. I'm just saying I don't have the energy to care about it.
I feel the same way, more or less. And also, Al Jazeera came out this week and said the only thing they're saying is that from that clinic, there was something sent to Peyton Manning's wife at some point. They said they weren't accusing Peyton Manning of anything. So no matter how this all comes down, I think it's much ado about nothing, and I honestly just don't care. So with that in mind...
Very good. Now, I learned to not care about this once I started hearing all the rumors that don't get reported of who's taking what. And some of the names were jaw-dropping, and I thought, you know what? It's just in all sports, not just pro football. But I thought, you know what? I'm just not – whatever. I'm going to put my head in the sand on this, which is real leadership on my part, I'm sure.
Hey, I'm not worried about it whatsoever. We're more concerned about the football games. And with that in mind, if you do want to go to a football game this week, if you want to catch a game that has playoff implications, maybe the Steelers game, maybe you want to go check out Vikings-Packers and see who's going to win the NFC North, the best way you can do that is by going and finding your tickets on SeatGeek. When you go to SeatGeek, you can use our code MMQB and you can get $20 off. Here's how it works. Download the SeatGeek app on your iPhone or Android. Then search for your event, find the deal, and enter our code MMQB. And when you make your purchase, SeatGeek will pay you $20 via check or PayPal. A little bit about SeatGeek. SeatGeek pulls all the ticket buying and selling options for other ticket sites into one place to save you time. SeatGeek also knows the fair market value of every ticket. They use that information to show you the best deals and help you find underpriced seats. So to make sure you redeem your promo code and get your $20 check, download the free SeatGeek app today. And again, enter our promo code MMQB and SeatGeek will send you $20 once you've made your first SeatGeek purchase. All right, Andy, let's start with that game I was mentioning. One game that's really has the most on the line. You know, both of these teams are in the playoffs, but we have a division title at stake. We have maybe, I mean, I'm not a big momentum guy when it comes to this part of the season, but just kind of figuring out where these teams are sitting at this moment in the season. We have Minnesota going to Green Bay on Sunday night. Two teams that looked very different in the second half of last Sunday. You have the Packers getting absolutely housed by Arizona, and you have Minnesota doing something similar to the Vikings or to the Giants at home. So I guess that's where we're sitting right now. What are you thinking about these two teams?
I'm thinking I would love to play against Green Bay in the playoffs this year. They, to me, have been a below-average offense that happens to have a great quarterback who's really not even playing great anymore because there's no rhythm or continuity in the passing game around him. Guys cannot get open in man against man coverage. And even lately, it's been against matchup zone coverage they've had trouble. The passing concepts aren't working. They've got issues at offensive tackle. If Bakhtiari is not healthy, and maybe he is, but if he's not, then that's a major problem like it was against Arizona. And their running game has been up and down this year. So I think Green Bay's defense is good, not great. And I think their offense is quite frankly, for what they have, I think it's very bad this year.
I mean, the problem for Green Bay against Arizona, outside of the fact that their guys couldn't get open and that Bakhtiari was hurt, is that everyone else on the offensive line was hurt. And at one point, I think it was Barclay at left tackle, Josh Sitton at left guard. They had to bring Corey Linsley in for J.C. Treader because Bulaga got hurt. So they had to move Treader to tackle and Linsley to center. And then Lang also got hurt. So at one point in the game, the only starter they had from when the game began was Josh Sitton, which against a real team, which Arizona absolutely is, that is a recipe for disaster. That's what gets your quarterback sacked 9 times, which is what happened to Aaron Rodgers on Sunday.
Well, and then the last part, the final domino that fell that really pushed him over the edge was eventually at right tackle, they had to bring in a very unproven guy in Josh Walker, who really hasn't had significant snaps before. And I hate to say this about any guy, but he really shouldn't have been on the field. He couldn't compete. So maybe that's not going to be an issue in the playoffs. Even if they've got healthy offensive linemen, though, and they've had a good offensive line play overall this year, the receiver situation's a significant problem, and it's been mitigated because they're bringing Randall Cobb out of the backfield more, which is creating different types of matchups. But Arizona navigated that. Minnesota has athletic linebackers, and they've got good zone principles, so that's going to diminish that on the inside with Cobb's running routes between the numbers. I've watched the film on every week, and every week it's the same exact issue. We've seen 16 or 15 games of it now, 16 weeks. The wide receivers aren't any good. They're not playing well, and that you have to pick against this team because of that.
I mean, the issue is that one exacerbates the other. If your wide receivers can't get open, then your quarterback needs to hold the ball a little bit longer, and if he's holding the ball with backup linemen, he's going to get destroyed. So, and if you can't, you need more time to get open, and if you don't have a line, it's just not going to happen. Right. So we have all of these problems, and there's nothing going right. But what about Minnesota? Do you think that Minnesota, I mean, obviously their performance last week was impressive, but is this a team that you feel maybe a little bit better about after the last couple weeks? Really, since that Arizona game, they played pretty well.
Yeah, they have. And by the way, one more note on Green Bay, because we got to be fair. Aaron Rodgers has played poorly as well. He's lost his rhythm and his confidence in the system working. There are throws that when they are open, too often he's not pulling the trigger either. So he's not a rhythmic QB by nature, but he's fallen way too out of what rhythm he did have to begin with. As far as Minnesota goes, that's a tough team to match up against defensively because they've got talent at all three levels, and they are very comfortable in the scheme they run. Mike Zimmer coaches those guys well. You can tell by the consistency of their technique and the organization. You almost never see them blow assignments there. That's a tough defense to play against. Offensively, we know what they are. They hide Bridgewater pretty well because they've got a running game and they can manufacture a passing game when they need be. I'm a little concerned about the passing game in the bigger scope, though. I think it's good enough to win a wild card game, but at some point you've got to convert third and long in the NFL, and I'm not so sure they've got the quarterback to consistently do that.
Yeah, I've worried about that passing game the entire season. I think seeing that Bridgewater didn't really make any steps forward, their offensive line has been really questionable. But you said a couple weeks ago something I thought was interesting. I asked you who you thought was the most valuable player on the Vikings defense, and you said Harrison Smith. And I didn't disagree, but seeing what he did on Sunday and just seeing what their defense has been like with him back, I think you might be right. And that's the biggest thing they've gotten in the last month or so, is they've gotten healthy on that side of the ball. They have the guys that really make them dangerous back. And right now, if all the defenses you can line up as we go into the playoffs, they're in the top five to me for the ones I would not want to see.
Same here. What Harrison Smith does for them, because they're very disguised base. That's what the double A gap blitz looks, where they put both linebackers up between the guard and the center. That's to set up disguises and various zone dropping concepts. They don't want you to know what the field's going to look like after the snap until the ball is snapped. And Harrison Smith's their biggest piece in that. That's why I think he's so valuable. I mean, for one, he's a great player, but for two, he's very rangy and very heady. And that combination gives them a lot of disguise elements. So it's a tough team to play against. And their pass rush is coming on as well. Hunter at defensive end, when he plays in the nickel and they move Robeson inside, that's a tough combination opposite Everson Griffin.
That's just such a nice find for them. I mean, like, they needed any more talent up front. And it just, he's a guy they, find in the third round, just stumble onto. Rick Spielman has done a really nice job there. I mean, they have a ton of young talent. And we're really seeing it come together, not on offense as much as on defense, but offensively, they still have one guy who at any time he could win a playoff game for you on that side of the ball. We saw he did that against Atlanta this year. It's not a playoff game, but he's the one that put them over the top. And when you have that defense plus a superstar running the ball like Adrian Peterson, it's enough. I don't know if it's enough to win more than one game, but I do think it's enough to win a single game.
I'll be interested to see how they run with Peterson in this game, because what they've done most of the year is go with inside zone, which is double teams at the point of attack. And it's here, Adrian, take the ball and just find the gap inside it and hit it. He doesn't like to run outside. I know his numbers are good outside. A lot of that's because he's so good at bouncing outside. But by design and structure, he's not a natural outside runner. He doesn't quite have the patience for it. But against Green Bay over the years, they've had success with unbalanced formations, because if you unbalance a formation, you put all your wide receivers on one side, you force the cornerbacks to become run defenders up front. Someone has to come and still play the edge across the tight ends. I would be interested to see if they attack. I think if Sam Shields is in, I think they're going to do that. I think they're going to attack him in the run game through formation and play design. Now, you know, it's a matter of how you do that, but I'm real curious to see if they're able to do that, because my guess is that's what they want to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think that makes sense. And if you're Norv Turner at this point, what you have to do is put all of your resources and all of that scheming and creativity into how you're going to run the ball, because their passing game just isn't going to be there this season. Bridgewater isn't there, and the talent isn't there. Even though Diggs has been a little bit of a surprise, that core just it doesn't have the dynamism you need to make a huge difference against real defenses when playoff time comes. If they're going to have a chance, yeah, it's because Peterson has a big game.
Yeah, no, I we're on the same page on that one.
So both of those teams, what they're looking for is to win the NFC North. And correct me if I'm wrong about this. So if Green Bay and Seattle both win on Sunday, that means that Seattle goes to Washington, correct? because that the Vikings have the head-to-head loss against Seattle, so that would hit them down to the sixth seed. But Green Bay beat Seattle, so they would have the head-to-head to go to the five seed. Is that right?
Yeah, that makes sense. So Seattle goes to Washington, and then we see Minnesota and Green Bay for a second week in a row, which ironically happened last time Minnesota made the playoffs in 2012. They played in week 17 and then again in the wild card.
So the way that I was looking at it before, when I didn't really totally grasp the playoff scenarios, is that winning this game would be nice because you get a home playoff game, but playing Seattle wouldn't be that nice. So if you're Minnesota, if you win this game, that's the treat you get. You get to face the Seahawks in the first round of the playoffs. As of 2 weeks ago, I felt like that would have been kind of a terrible prize. But Seattle didn't look that impressive against St. Louis. I mean, this is a team that, even with Russell Wilson playing as well as he did, they clearly have, you know, the seams are evident on offense. We know where they are. Their offensive line is a problem. And we saw that. You know, Russell Wilson gets hit, I think, 13 times during in that game. He gets dumped on the ground by William Hayes over and over again. Going into the playoffs, are you at least even the slightest bit concerned about that Seattle offensive line and how it's going to match up against those playoff teams in the NFC?
Well, I need to see one more week, because Seattle's offense, and it starts with Wilson, was tremendous for five games in a row here, and then they were not against St. Louis. And I don't know if it was a hiccup or a step back, and I could see it being either way. The hiccup being, well, Wilson was tremendous in the pocket, and all of a sudden he wasn't. He didn't play well. He left throws on the field. He held the ball at times, and that exposed what was already an iffy offensive line. I could also see it being a step back, because what I just described about Wilson has kind of been his MO over his career, and he just masks it with incredible playmaking prowess. So I'm real curious to see how he looks bouncing back this week. Now, something to consider, Seattle has never matched up well against St. Louis, and sometimes that's just, especially within divisions, that happens. I mean, the Rams have always, for the most part, always played them tough. They did beat them earlier this year, so maybe that's the idea. And if it's about matchups, we have to assume Seattle matches up pretty well to Minnesota, because they went up to Minnesota and throttled them a few weeks ago. I don't think you're suggesting this, Mays, but if there's any thought at all of, well, it's not in the Vikings' best interest to win and host Seattle, there's no team in the NFL good enough, and especially a new playoff team, no team's good enough to decide when they win and lose. I think you got to play all out every week.
Totally, and I still think you choose the home playoff game. Even if you think Seattle is better than Washington, I think you want to play at home, especially in the playoffs. And that's just for – could you imagine if you went to your owner and said, yeah, we're going to give up a home playoff game? The guy would lose his mind. That's not a choice you can make. So we're looking at Seattle, and they're playing Arizona this week. They're going to Arizona. Arizona has a little bit on the line. If the Panthers lose and the Cardinals win, they're looking at home field advantage throughout. I'm not seeing Carolina losing this game. I mean, they're much better than Tampa, and I think after last week, I feel kind of bad that the Bucs have to play them right now. But if you're looking at Arizona, and just based on what they did to Green Bay, if you had to stack them up against Carolina and Seattle right now, who would you say was the most dangerous of those three?
I think most explosive is Arizona. So maybe that – does that equate to danger? I guess that's up to interpretation, but – they have the best passing game of those three teams by far. And they probably have the third best defense, but it's the most aggressive defense. And we see what aggressive defense can do, because they scored two touchdowns on defense and had nine sacks against Green Bay. So there's an explosiveness to their defense. What's your answer to the question?
I don't know. I mean, are we really knocking Carolina out of the top spot because they lost one game and it happened to come in week 16?
No, not at all.
I don't know. I still think it's Arizona.
I've been saying Arizona. I think Arizona's been the better team all year long. I know the record's not better, but to me, Arizona's a better or a more frightening team than Carolina overall.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, you're looking at the numbers. Arizona's number one in DVOA as of today. You know, Carolina's sitting down there at six, which is probably a little bit low, but I think that Arizona, dangerous is the word with them. I mean, they have the most explosive passing game. They have a running game that has some pop now with David Johnson. They have guys on the scheme on defense is opportunistic. They do make plays. They do pop. You're right. I mean, that's what they do on that side of the ball. And now that Dwight Freeney's playing like he's been shot out of a cannon, that adds a slightly new element to what they do. So I still lean toward Arizona. And that's kind of the itch I've had all year. is that nagging feeling that, man, you just watch this team and, God, you don't want to play against them. I mean, the way that they throw the ball and how quickly they can beat you and just how fast the game can be over against them. I mean, they've blown teams out in a way that no one else in the league has this year. So that element makes me scared of them. I still think Carolina's defense is dangerous. And I don't know, maybe what Seattle did last week is recency bias is creeping into my thinking. It's tough to say. I think that the NFC right now has the most dangerous trifecta of teams. That's what I would say. I feel like those teams have the best chance of winning the Super Bowl as of right now.
Those are probably three of the top four and certainly top five defenses in the NFL. I mean, Kansas City and Denver and New England and the AFC would be in the discussion. But the defenses we're describing, they're all matchup zone type of defenses. That's a complicated order because these teams, Arizona, Carolina, Seattle, have been in these same systems for several years. A lot of them have the same players for the last several years, and they become very, very proficient at what they do. Watching the film, I think Seattle might be the scariest of the three defenses because their track record's the longest, and they look like they're playing fast again. They're playing fast across the board. They look like their former selves. I don't know Cam Chancellor's status. McCray's been actually very good in place of him lately. But if they have Cam Chancellor healthy for the playoffs, relatively fresh, that defensive line's found a new burst with Frank Clark at D-tackle and nickel. The cornerback situation got figured out with Shedd playing opposite Sherman and Jeremy Lane back. That's the Seahawks defense that we've come to know. They're back. And that might be the one of all three of these teams, and Arizona and Carolina are great, but that might be the one I fear the most, given that they've done it before in the playoffs.
I think Seattle has the highest ceiling of any defense. I think you're right. But I think it's hard to ignore what Carolina has done the entire season, just their body of work. Even if you look at them losing that game last week, it took an act of God from Julio Jones for them to lose that game. I mean, it's not like Atlanta moved the ball consistently. The one area where you might be a little bit concerned is what that team looked like on offense. They struggled to move the ball against an Atlanta defense that's pretty bad. I mean, a team that really doesn't have much talent outside of one cornerback and a banged up rookie defensive end. So that, if I'm looking at Carolina, I'm saying this is what I'm worried about with them. It's their offense. When you watch that game against the Falcons, do you have a similar feeling?
Well, conceptually, yes, because along the thread of what we're talking about. So this is why this is Mays. This is exactly why I think Arizona is more dangerous. Both Arizona and Carolina are highly manufactured passing attacks. They're both downfield vertical passing attacks that take big shots and try to beat you with home runs. The difference, and last week against Atlanta, the concepts did not work. Atlanta, if you play sound fundamental football, you're going to take away a passing attack like that, or you're going to have a chance to, and Atlanta did that. It's hard to do that against Arizona because not only are they well schemed, and they, like Carolina, they have a great pocket passing quarterback, but they've got so much speed at wide receiver that we're talking about good scheme and explosive traits. Carolina doesn't have that. They have Ted Ginn, but nobody fears Ted Ginn. He's not John Brown. He's not Nelson. He's not Michael Floyd. He's not Jerron Brown that the Cardinals have. So I think the Cardinals are the one team in the NFC that has the great scheme plus a personnel grouping that can transcend a great scheme even. They can win even when the plays are defended well.
I agree with that, but I think the difference with Arizona is that their passing game isn't manufactured. It's not misdirection screens and play action throws that you have, you know, two guys in the route and you need one guy to beat the other with speed. You have every once in a while you get Michael Floyd on a dig or something like Larry Fitzgerald playing out of the slot. They have middle-of-the-field threats in the passing game outside of one tight end. They can beat you everywhere on the field, and I just don't feel that way about Carolina. I think they have screens to running backs, Greg Olsen, and throws outside the numbers to Ted Ginn. That's what they have. Arizona has 20 things. So even though they're both built around throwing the ball deep, I think that Arizona is whoever they want to be. Carolina is who they have to be.
That's a great way to say it. I think we're saying the same thing. When I say a scheme passing attack, what that means is that they can win through the play design. The play design can out-leverage you. It's not like Green Bay where everyone lines up and they're hoping that one receiver beats a cornerback and that's how they win.
Sure.
There are certain things Arizona does where it's just the geometry of football that takes over. Seattle's not that kind of a passing attack, at least not consistently yet. Green Bay certainly is not. Minnesota has to be, but they're so much more limited. But yeah, what you're saying, Arizona can be whatever they want to be, and but they're also very well designed. They're extremely well designed.
Oh, totally. And I don't want to get into that too much. I have a lot of interesting things to say about that, but I don't want to step on what I'm going to write about that for next week. I had some very interesting conversations with guys like Drew Stanton and John Brown just about the way that Bruce Arians does create that geometry of football. And it's fascinating, but it's going to be more fascinating in print. So just wait a few days.
Yeah, no, we won't step on your toes. Did you get a chance to talk to Arians for that piece at all?
I did. Yeah, we
did. He answer your questions? Did he answer your questions in like one or two words?
He did not.
Really? See, no. The conversation I had with him one time, it was like I had like four or five things prepared. We were just chatting. It wasn't an interview, but I was thinking this will take 10 or 15 minutes, and it took like three because he just gets right to the point and answers it with no window dressing whatsoever. And I asked people about it and they said, yeah, that's just how he is.
The questions I was asking weren't very technical. I think that's part of it. I was asking things that if he was going to wax philosophical, he would have. It was about some stuff that's happened in the past, and it was more about getting him in storytelling mode than it was about asking actual schematic things. For that kind of stuff, I relied more on the players just to be a conduit for how he tells them about it. Because I don't know if he'd be able to tell me about it. I don't know if I'd be able to wrap my head around it. But by playing a little game of telephone and saying, all right, asking Drew Stanton literally, when he tells you about the offense, how does he describe it to you? That's what I was trying to get from the guys. From him, it was more about the way he fell in love with this kind of football and everything else. Again, I'm saying too much, but I think we're probably asking different lines of questions.
I'm eager to read it because I know you also talk to other teams that are fascinating to me, two other teams, and you can say them if you want or you can just move on.
Well, unfortunately for me, a little bit look behind the curtain, I talked about to the Steelers, and they may not make the stupid playoffs. So
I know, that's kind of messed me up too, although I wrote my article this week based on the idea that they won't make the playoffs because if you look at the AFC QBs, a startling 5 out of 6 of those guys are journeyman, middle tier, or backups guys. Brady's the only household name at quarterback in the AFC playoffs this year.
So I got an email today from a couple of my old Grantland cohorts listing out the finishings in our fantasy football league. And it was just another reminder that after a season of dominating the league, I came away with virtually nothing. And that is one of the dangers of yearly fantasy football, is that you can put in a season's worth of emotions and time, and in the end, none of it matters. You know where that doesn't happen? FanDuel. Even though your yearly fantasy football team may have gone south in a big, big hurry, that's not going to happen when you play FanDuel. FanDuel is easy and fun, and you can play for cash against other fans all the way up to the Super Bowl. There's no year-long commitment. You can also start a listener league to compete with your friends. Now, when you play on FanDuel.com with our code, the MMQB, your first tournament is risk-free. That's any contest offered on FanDuel at up to $10. If you win, you keep the money. If you lose, FanDuel will refund your account for more play. FanDuel is the best place to play one-week fantasy football. To get started, go to FanDuel.com and click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner. Use the code, the MMQB, and sign up now. All right, let's get into the AFC playoffs, and let's start what we were talking about before with those quarterback matchups and the fact that after looking like it was going to be Ben Roethlisberger going into the AFC playoffs with a dangerous offense again, it seems like we might be switching out Ryan Fitzpatrick for Ben Roethlisberger. So as of last week, if the Steelers had won out, they control their own destiny, which is a terrible phrase, but I'm leaning on it because I'm tired and struggling for words today. So because they had a common opponent advantage over the Jets, if they had the same record at the end of the season, Pittsburgh gets in, the Jets go home, whatever hope the Jets had coming into the year is lost. Now, with the Jets beating New England last week and the Ravens beating the Steelers, it's the opposite. The Jets now, if they win next week, and even if the Steelers win, they're in the playoffs. So, I mean, first things first, looking at those two games from last week, how shocked were you to see that happen?
Very shocked. And if Pittsburgh, not so much on the Jets side, I thought if I had to pick, I would have guessed New England would have won the game. But watching the film, New England came in kind of scared almost of that one with the Jets. They acted like an offense that knew it was not as good as the defense they were facing. They were condensed and highly controlled in their play designs. in the first half, and they even did trick plays three in a row at one point, which you'd never see from New England, including the Wildcat that didn't.
Can you blame them? Can you blame them for thinking their offense wasn't as good as the Jets' defense? Keyshawn Martin is their best receiver.
Yeah, no, I get it. And they beat the Jets, but they had other receivers in. Now they don't have those guys in. My guess is they are regretting that approach, though, because when they came out in the second half, they looked like the Patriots again. And they put Brady at greater risk, and he did pay a price for it. But they were at least competitive. And if they played that way in the first half, the outcome may very well have been different. So I was surprised, but not necessarily surprised, because the Jets are a good defense, and they matched up well. And New England knew that going in. And because of that, it was going to inherently be a close game. The Steelers one totally surprised me because Baltimore, you know, they've got everybody at backup now. I mean, every position save for, I think, two of them are filled by backups, including every skill position. So if you can't beat that kind of team, and Baltimore's, they've competed, they've looked pretty good on film for what they have, but they do look like a team with a lot of backups. If you can't beat that team, you don't deserve to be in the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, these games are all based on so, you know, a ton of just tiny little things. You know, with that Pittsburgh game, if that ball is completed to Antonio Brown in the end zone, the game probably goes differently. If D'Angelo Williams gets that fourth and one on the first drive, that game probably goes differently. If Antonio Brown gets that second foot in bounds on that 18-yard throw down the right sideline in the second half, the Steelers probably win that game. It's, I mean, this is how every NFL game works. But I'm not as scared about the Steelers as the game and the outcome may lead you to believe or may lead you to want to be. I think they're still a very dangerous team, and they played a team that got more pressure than they've gotten normally and made a couple big plays. I mean, the pick that Jimmy Smith made on that tipped ball, that's a game changer, and that's 2 inches from being incomplete. So I don't know. Somebody asked me yesterday who I think is the most dangerous team in the AFC, and I still, in my opinion, it's a team not currently in the playoffs, which sounds ridiculous, but I still believe that.
I believe that too. I think, in fact, the article I was going to write for Extra Point, I couldn't do it because Pittsburgh didn't win, but it was exactly that, is I think they're the best team heading into the AFC postseason, and if they got into the sixth seed and faced New England in the second round, I would pick Pittsburgh to win that game in New England. But Mays, I mean, yeah, you can split hairs on it, but the bottom line is they faced a team with all backups, and the team played very basic two high coverages, which Baltimore's done before, and that stymied, or at least it slowed down, the most prolific dynamic offense in the NFL. There's no reasonable explanation for that other than one of the teams didn't show up and play its best.
Do you think they went away from the run a little too quickly?
No, because I understood why they were running. The safeties were back so deep for Baltimore, and they were gaining yards. The run was working. The problem with the run game and why it's kind of phased out in the NFL is it eats up clock, it makes your drives longer, and that can keep a game artificially close. So they ran the ball very well in the first half, and they had very little points, and it was a close contest. They had nothing to show for it. So the second half, they came out and said, we're going to do what we do. We're going to be our most dangerous selves and attack you. And it's almost like the Patriot thing a little bit, is New England had they took the smart approach, or what the best approach on paper was, which is run the ball, be controlled against a defense that's better than you. But they got away from what they do best, and Pittsburgh did the same thing. Both those teams were much better in the second half because they went back to their own identities.
But do you think that's a weakness of a team, the fact that they're so interested in doing exactly what they want to do that they aren't doing what they should do?
Well, what's the difference between what do you mean by that? What is what they want to do and what is what they should do?
I mean, if a defense is begging you to run the ball and it's working, even if it is keeping the game artificially close, it's working. You're moving the ball. You're getting first downs. You're not throwing it to the other team, which they did twice.
I get what you're saying. I mean, how many points do they have in the first half, though? We got to look it up here. Just a second.
It wasn't many, but they had a fourth and one inside the 25 and they didn't get it. And then that was also in the first half when Brown caught that ball in the end zone and they only got three. So you figure that's maybe a 10-point swing there. So, I mean, it's not as if they weren't moving it and they weren't close to scoring. It's just that they didn't come away with it in the end.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. And they went into halftime down 13-3, so you could also argue that was a little bit of why it went the way it did, because maybe they felt like they had to throw, being down two scores, and especially the game's taking, it's going faster than expected because the run play is keeping the clock moving. I don't know. I mean, Pittsburgh, Mays, you and I agree about Pittsburgh. It's one of the best passing attacks in terms of firepower that we've ever seen, correct?
Yes.
So I think 30,000 foot perspective, doesn't it just reason that if you're going to go out and use that passing attack, that's not the worst thing in the world, even if it's against two deep coverages?
I don't know, because when I was watching the Packers last year and they were really rolling, it's when they said when teams are playing too high on them, okay, we're just going to beat the hell out of you. We're going to run it up your throat for 6 yards a carry, and if that's what you want us to do, we can do that too. And I think that's when you become truly dangerous. It doesn't matter how terrifying your passing attack is if you can't punish teams when they make you run it. And I thought they were doing a good job of that, and I just feel like they went away from it too early. I don't know.
I don't disagree with you. The last thing I'll say to it, though, just as a devil's advocate thing, because this is a fascinating discussion, but Green Bay doesn't have Martavis Bryant and Antonio Brown, and those guys are significant deep threats, and they can separate from any type of coverage. Green Bay's got good downfield receivers, and Jordy Nelson's healthy. They did last year. But Jordy Nelson's not, even though he's more productive, he's not Martavis Bryant, and he's certainly not Antonio Brown.
Yeah, you're probably right. I'll concede that one to you. And again, we spend all this time talking about the Steelers. The Jets are in the playoffs as it currently stands. We've talked about the Jets a little bit. I've said that I thought the way they constructed this offense especially was kind of fascinating. Do you believe that with Brandon Marshall playing the way that he is, with Eric Decker on that team, and with this defense being really good, that they're actually a team that somebody wouldn't want to run into in the playoffs?
Yes, because they have a defense that's going to keep the game close. That's a dominant defense. We forget we kind of forget that, don't we, how good that defense is?
Yeah, you just kind of take it for granted. It's funny.
So I think they've really understood and figured out what they are offensively. And there's a few elements that make the Jets who they are. One is that they spread out. They use four wide receivers on about 35% of their snaps almost. That's by
crazy.
Far the most in the NFL. Yeah. So when you spread out, you define things for Ryan Fitzpatrick. You give a little greater margin for error because when he does rifle the ball into tight coverage, at least it's not into multiple defenders inside the numbers. It's everyone spread out, defense included. You also give your running backs a little bit of space. They have guys that can create just enough. They're not superstars, but Ivory, Bilal, Powell, those guys aren't the easiest to tackle. And then they have the guys playing in the right spots. Marshall as the X ISO on the weak side, where if he is double teamed, it's a more defined double team, and that opens up stuff on the other side. And then Decker in the slot, where he's been very, very proficient. So I think the Jets makeup really matches their personnel. It's an impressive job by the coaching staff, because they've taken what they have and really fit to what they do best. And Chan Gailey knew how to use Fitzpatrick, because he played this way when he had Fitzpatrick in Buffalo.
I tweeted this on Sunday, and I'll just run back my tweets, because I guess that's something I do now. Watching Brandon Marshall play the way that he is for that Jets team, I just know that life so much, where you lived this wide receiver starved existence, and then Brandon Marshall comes to you like an oasis in the desert and lulls you into loving him for an entire season. And then 2 years down the line, I know what's going to happen. And I just watch my Jet fan friends, and they're just enamored. They're just being enamored with Marshall. And I just feel so bad that I know what's happening. It's like when you see a relationship that's played out for you in the past, and you know the heartbreak that's down the road, but you don't have what it takes to tell that friend what's going to happen to them.
Well, Mays, you're a bitter Bears fan. That's what you are.
I mean, there's no other kind of Bears fan. That's the only sort of Bears fan that exists at this point.
Brandon Marshall, he's 31 now, and I don't want to disparage the guy or talk, patronize him, but I think he's maybe grown up. Doesn't he strike you as, he's a different temperament now than he was early in his career. And granted, he's probably not the most stable guy. He'd probably tell you he's not the most stable guy, but I'm rooting for him to succeed, because I see a guy that's undergone personal growth and has been willing to do it publicly too, to help others in his position. That doesn't mean what you're saying isn't incorrect, though. My fingers are crossed. I'm hopeful for Brandon Marshall.
I'm mostly kidding. I mean, I think that most of those problems last year in that Bears locker room were not about Brandon Marshall's old personality coming home. It was about the problems in that locker room and the lack of oversight and everything else. It's funny that this has played out so many times, that he comes in and plays so well somewhere, and then you know, inevitably, for whatever reason, it doesn't go well. So good for you, Jets fans. Enjoy this while it lasts. I'm not sure how long it will. Hopefully it does. He's a fun player, so I don't mind seeing him play at this level again. It's enjoyable. So with this AFC playoffs, we have the – no matter – really, there's no good reason to talk about the scenarios because there are 8 million of them. All the seeds are still up in the air. So this Jets-Steelers situation, we don't know who they're playing. So when the games get figured out, we'll preview them. But until then, I think it's better just to talk about these teams as they exist in the greater scheme. And the other two teams we haven't gotten to yet are the Broncos and the Bengals, who just played. And they may have just played with two quarterbacks we weren't ready for at the beginning of the season, but it still feels like we have a pretty good idea of what they are in a lot of capacities. As we march toward the playoffs here, what do you think about both of these teams?
Well, when we first talked about A.J. McCarron coming in for Andy Dalton, Robert, I told you I want to see a game or two because how they use him will tell you a lot about how they feel about him. And so far, the way they've used McCarron is as a watered-down version of Dalton, which I think is a good thing. They haven't changed who they are stylistically to accommodate McCarron. In fact, you see him even making adjustments at the line of scrimmage before the snap. They've done their formation variation. They run the same route concepts in the same parts of the field that they have been. They still look like the Bengals. They just need everybody else around him to step their game up, which is what Hugh Jackson said a few weeks ago. So I'm encouraged. I thought McCarron's looked pretty good. The San Francisco, we didn't get a good read on him because he didn't have to make any plays. I thought he did some good things against Denver. I haven't seen the coach's film, but watching the TV, he threw the ball extremely well, in my opinion.
Yeah, and especially against what is probably the best team best defense in the league. So you don't mind that at all. It's the matter of the ceiling. I still think the ceiling is extremely low. You know, he averaged 5.7 yards an attempt against Denver, and that's fine. He didn't turn the ball over. He was okay, but it's still no one that you're excited about, and no offense that you're excited about as long as he's in charge.
Wasn't it interesting that Denver went to more zone coverage in the second half?
Yeah.
Which they'd get, you know, their man stuff hadn't worked. It's 6 quarters in a row now, by the way, that their man coverage stuff has been exploited. So maybe we see them alter their approach late in the season. But that when they went to zone coverage, clearly the tenor of the game changed. And you wonder if that's a little bit of McCarron's inexperience. I'm sure they prepared him for man-to-man all year or all week long because that's what Denver's played all year long. And when they switch up to zone, maybe that tripped him up just a little bit. I don't know. I mean, against San Francisco, the Niners were all zone, so it's not like he's never seen it before. But I'd be interested to ask Hugh Jackson and Ken Zampezi, their quarterback's coach, if they thought that was a factor with McCarron. If it is a factor, that has to be corrected because you can't have a formula to beat you like that.
I'm interested about if that persists after this, because with Seattle, it seemed like they went to that more wide open attack as the way to attack the Steelers. And in doing so, discovered that they might be better playing this way. So I'd be curious to see if with Denver, they saw what happens when they play zone and how teams react to it. And maybe that's something they fold in a little bit more as we get into the playoffs.
Yeah, that's entirely possible. It's entirely possible. How'd you feel Osweiler played on the other side?
I thought he looked okay. And so here's the thing about that Bengals defense. And we talked about this last week before as we were previewing this game. Geno Atkins is a superstar. He changed who they were defensively. And he played only about half the snaps yesterday. And that really does hurt their defense. And I think that Osweiler looked a ton better against what is usually a dangerous, scary Cincinnati defense than he did against some of these teams that aren't nearly as good defensively.
I was impressed overall because his struggles, especially the second half struggles, which everyone's made a big deal about, they came against cover two defenses. Not San Diego quite so much, but Oakland and then Pittsburgh, who they're not a cover two, but that's what they played against Denver. And Cincinnati's been the best two high safety cover two type defense in the NFL all season long. So I was skeptical of him coming into that game, and not just him, but that whole offense. So the passing game was not in sync on a variety of levels. I was skeptical, but obviously they answered the call. And to answer the call after falling behind, if you're down 14, you know the Bengals are even more comfortable in cover two. Since he blitzed more than I thought they would, and Osweiler responded well to that, I was very encouraged overall with his performance.
Yeah, I think with the level of talent they have at receiver, with that defense, What you can say about him is he's not playing poorly enough to make you discouraged about their chances, especially in that conference, because if you look at New England and just how banged up they are, and if you look at every other team, it's not like everyone has a chance. Every single one of those teams, if they hit it right for three games, can probably go to the Super Bowl. That includes Kansas City. So I think that
Do you think that includes Houston? Does that include Houston in your mind? Because I think that does include Houston, because their defense is as good as these other teams we're talking about.
Oh, I was going to say that I never include the AFC South when I'm talking about professional football. But,
oh, Maze, come on now. AFC South represented the AFC in the championship round last year.
Yeah, but that was with a healthy Andrew Luck and some actual football being played by some of those teams.
I know.
I was not going to include Houston, but all those other teams, I would say they have as good a chance as anybody right now. So I think when you watch Osweiler last night, that's what you've got to think. You've got to think, man, we have a lot of talent on defense. If he gets the ball into Demaryius Thomas's hands, we can do this. So that's the thing. And with your backup quarterback, what you want is for him not to discourage your chances of winning. And I think the difference between Cincinnati and Denver right now is that Osweiler does that less than McCarron does.
Last thing I'll say about Denver, I've been surprised that we haven't seen, and they've done a little bit more of it than they did with Manning, but not completely. I've been surprised we haven't seen the Kubiak zone play action game as much. They haven't moved the pocket with Roethlisberger a whole lot. They look similar to how they did when Peyton Manning was quarterbacking them. I didn't expect that. I thought once Osweiler came in, Kubiak would scratch that itch of his to finally get back to his zone staples. And they've done it a little bit, but it's not become their identity by any means.
They've been under center a little bit more, though, which is a difference. And I think that the running backs are probably more comfortable with that.
I would agree with that. Adam Gase told me that he felt the running backs liked the pistol more because they're hidden by the quarterback.
Interesting. And they'd be even more hidden with the Ent that plays quarterback for them right now. I mean, it's impossible to see anybody behind him.
Right. Yeah, good point. I thought John Gruden's point, and it was one of those I wish I'd made it, but I had never. I don't coach, so I wouldn't have thought of it. That defenders can, when you're 6'7", defenders can see you better as a passer, and that might be why you're at a disadvantage. There's something to being tall and being a quarterback. The NFL hasn't had any tall QBs. No one over 6'6 has succeeded as an NFL quarterback before. There's only been like five guys who've even played at that height. And that can't be a coincidence with the number of talented athletes that come in at that size. And Gruden's point about defenders being able to see you more, that to me is a fascinating one.
Yeah, I agree, but I'm not going to, you know, poor Brock Osweiler, he's tall and handsome, like, I'm sure his life is really difficult. Like, I would be 6'7 Brock Osweiler over 5'11, you know, frumpy me any day. So, on that note, I think that's all I got, man. Do you have anything else you want to add, or are we out of here this week?
No, we're out of here, and then when we're talking at this time next week, it'll be wild card time. I love the NFL playoffs. As an analyst, there's so much less work for you to do because there's only four games a week, and yet everybody cares more about the work you do. It's an ideal scenario.
I can feel the happiness seething out of you right now. It makes me happy. It's contagious, and I appreciate it. All right, Andy, as always, thanks to our producer, Dan Freeman. Thanks to our researcher, John Daigle. And we'll be back next week, hopefully with Klemko and hopefully with a lot of playoff-heavy football to talk about.
Thanks, man. It's always fun.
Thanks, guys.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team. Every day.